Welcome back to Alive at 5. I'm your host, David Leonard, and it's my pleasure to spend some time on the phone today with Gregory Wrightstone. Greg is the author of a book entitled Inconvenient Facts, The Science That Al Gore Doesn't Want You to Know. I wanted him to come on the program with me here today and spend some time talking about the phenomenon of climate change, what used to be called global warming. And we're going to spend some time talking about this issue. Is it real? Are people trying to make political hay out of this? What is this really all about? I wanted Greg to come on the program and help set the record straight for us there. Greg, welcome aboard. It's a pleasure to spend some time with you here today.
Oh, outstanding. Thank you. Thank you for having me. And it's good to get on and talk with you.
Here at the beginning, for somebody out there that may not be familiar with you, if you'd be so kind, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who's Greg Wrightstone?
Well, I'm a geologist. I've worked for more than 35 years studying various aspects of the Earth's history. But your listeners may be pretty interested to know I did not set out to write a book. I set out to seek the truth. I knew that some of the things as a geologist we were being told about the climate and our changing climate was just wrong, and I suspected other things were. So I went back to the very base data from NASA, NOAA, and at the beginning here, I just didn't trust anybody. I said, I want to see for myself, and I want to look and see what the truth is. And frankly, what I found was just shocking in that most of what we're being told about these pending climate apocalypse events are they're either not happening or actually we're improving. Things like forest fires. Everybody thinks forest fires are increasing, but if you look at the long-term worldwide data, we've been in a significant long-term decline worldwide of forest fires. And we'll get into that in a little bit of why that is so. But this news cycle, 24-hour, 365-day-a-year news cycle just drives things like burning forests and homes going up in flame, that puts it right on the front page there. The book really fell out of that search for the truth. So it's a rather strange way to go about writing a book, but I was really driven in this, and I really threw myself into the writing of the book. If you look at the memoriam at the front page of the book there, we lost our oldest son a little over a year and a half ago. And I think this was somewhat therapeutic for me. So it was really not only just a search for the truth, but also perhaps therapy for me to accept everything.
Well, Greg, I certainly have to tell you at this point, I'm very sorry to have learned of your loss.
Well, I appreciate that. I didn't, it was really people say, how do you get over stuff like that? And it's doing something like that, and it really was. But it's I'm almost on a mission here, because the overarching theme of the book really is that rising temperatures, and they're rising, and increasing CO2, and it's increasing, are leading to a prospering Earth, a prospering of humanity. We're seeing that Earth is thriving, prospering, greening, and the human condition is improving because of climate change. The things that we hear about, the catastrophes, are just that, predictions of things that may or may not occur 30, 50, or 80 years in the future, and they're all based on flawed and failed climate models that overpredict warming by 2.5 to 3 times too much. So I live in the real world. I look at what's actually happening, and I took it as the context where I looked at it is, well, we've had more than 300 years of warming. We're increasing CO2. Shouldn't we be able to recognize some of those, what I call the climate apocalypse events? Shouldn't they be occurring today? And we find they're not. We find that, for example, drought is actually decreasing over the last 100-plus years, 150 years. It's not increasing, contrary to what you might read in the press, and that's very well documented. In the book, I capture a chart of what they call the most severe and intense droughts of the 20th century, and we find most all of those occurred prior to the year 1960, with the last 40 years of the 20th century with very low numbers of these severe and intense droughts. So I'll tell you, your listeners, they should sleep well. And driving their SUV to the corner grocery isn't going to destroy the earth. It sure doesn't look like it's happening now.
Greg, one of the things I wanted to ask you about early in the interview today is the second half of the title of your book, Inconvenient Facts, is the first part. The science that Al Gore mm-hmm. doesn't want you to know. That's what caught my attention, I have to admit. Explain that phrase for us. What are you getting at there?
Well, I'm getting at I list 60 inconvenient facts in the book that you won't find out there in the media. They run counter to this notion of human-caused apocalyptic warming. There are two sides to the argument. One side are what I call the climate alarmists that say that increases in CO2 are driving abnormally high temperatures, that the temperatures we're seeing are unusual and unprecedented. On the other hand, are people like me that are skeptics, climate skeptics. We don't dispute that climate change is happening. We don't dispute that the temperature has been warming over the centuries. Thank goodness it's been warming, by the way, and we can go into that a little bit. And the CO2 that we're adding to the atmosphere, we've increased from 280 parts per million at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and we're a little over 400 now. So we've increased CO2, and it's mainly from burning fossil fuels. So that increase in CO2, CO2 is a greenhouse gas, so necessarily CO2 increase has to add a bit of warming to the atmosphere, although I would argue that it's modest to small and entirely overwhelmed by the same natural forces that have been driving temperatures up and down and up and down since the dawn of time. Those natural forces driving temperature, they didn't cease at the beginning of the 20th century. Al Gore, Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State and their ilk, they want your listeners to believe that the temperature drivers, again, that have been driving temperatures up and down, suddenly ceased at the beginning of the 20th century. Now it's all completely driven by human-caused CO2. And that's not the way nature works. That's not science. Your listeners aren't stupid. They know that those same natural forces are with us today, just as they have been. They didn't go away. So, there's with Al Gore, your listeners may not know, he only took one science course in college and got a D in it. And this is the guy we're supposed to listen to concerning this extremely important subject.
One of the things that you point out early in the book, I believe it's in the foreword of the acknowledgments, I believe it's in the foreword, you talk about something that you refer to as the non-expert problem. And I wanted you to tell us about that today, Greg, because I think this gets back to the reference you made to the listeners not being stupid. And I agree, the listeners out there, people in general, are not stupid, but they could be vexed by the non-expert problem. So fill us in.
Yeah, and just about everybody, if you're not a scientist and you're not really well versed on the subject matter, most people are reticent to talk about climate change or argue with anybody because, frankly, there's so much contradictory information, and they're not qualified. They don't think they're qualified as scientists to make that judgment. When I was writing the book, Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert, had a blog post concerning this, and Scott's a true climate skeptic, but he called it the non-scientist problem, is what he referred it. That most of us really doubt what we're being told, a lot of it, about climate change, but don't feel that they're qualified to be able to make a judgment. And that's why I wrote this book. I wrote this book for non-scientists. I wanted to make it readable, understandable. I wanted to have full-color graphs. There are 91 illustrations in the book, high-quality, full-color illustrations that are really easy to understand. And I wanted to empower people like your listeners with this information that they could go forward. And in fact, in order to empower your listeners, I'm offering you and your listeners a PowerPoint of the top 25 charts in the book. That way, if their idiot brother-in-law from Fargo posts something on Facebook about polar bears going extinct, they can have a chart from me that they can post on Facebook. Oh, what about this 60 years of polar bear population history that shows it's increasing? And that way we can have this information is powerful, and I've seen it used on LinkedIn, Facebook a lot. People using this is just a great resource, and they can get that by going to inconvenientfacts.xyz and hit the subscribe button, and I'll send you a link for the PowerPoint. Again, it's something for your listeners to use. Even scientists, my colleagues that believe as I do, they're a little bit reticent to talk about this because they're not quite as empowered as I am and have the in-depth knowledge. Because sometimes we start talking about this and we talk about it's always thrown up a 97% consensus, which I devote an entire chapter in the book to dispelling that notion. It's tough for scientists to get out there and talk. Although we'll be going in 2 weeks to Houston, speaking as the featured speaker at a breakfast, 4,500 people there, scientists, I might say, engineers, geologists. And I've been speaking in front of scientific gatherings, and I've been very, very well received. In fact, the typical response are people coming up and vigorously shaking my hand afterward, thanking me for writing the book and having the courage to do that and to speak out.
Greg, obviously the non-expert problem, as you put it, I think has contributed to this, but what has led to this state we're in these days, I guess? The only way to describe it, I think, is climate change alarmism. That's a phrase I found in your book, and I really like that because I thought that just absolutely sums up the attitude of so many people. If you ever, as you point out, it's almost difficult to talk to anybody about this because as soon as you do, you know, you're instantly a bad guy if you disagree with them. And it doesn't really matter too much to them what scientific facts you're able to produce.
Yep. And we need to be able to talk rationally. And I hope your listeners just say, oh, it's a hoax. Climate change is happening. We have to, you know, if you just say it's not happening, well, that's just not true. Climate change has been happening forever. And we are in a warming trend. It's been warming in fits and starts for 300 years. So we got to own up to that. It's difficult for people to get out there and talk about this because, it's so polarized. At the beginning of the book, I have a quote from H.L. Mencken, in which, to paraphrase him, he said that governments and institutions need to create hobgoblins, imaginary hobgoblins of alarm, with which to frighten the population. That way the population will otherwise accept otherwise onerous and painful regulations like the Paris Climate Accord, that these hobgoblins of alarm are needed to thoroughly frighten the population. And I think that's climate alarmism is one of these hobgoblins, and the other ones that are associated with it that go back to, really, they feed into an anti-carbon dioxide fear is, you know, anti-pipeline, anti-oil and gas, anti-coal, anything associated that man is doing to create carbon dioxide. And it may well go back really to an anti-capitalist agenda. I'm not sure what else to attribute it to. I in the book itself, I stay science and fact-based with not too much political interpretation in there. But because when we start talking about this and we start talking about what has to be a giant conspiracy, you almost feel like you ought to be wearing a tinfoil hat sometimes. But boy, I tell you, we go through the book and read it, you'll see that, boy, it's everything I point to and how what we're being told is 180 degrees opposite of what's actually happening. you know, why are some of these people lying to us? I think they're well-intentioned people that have been led astray, but you can't get the anti alarmist science needs to be. They try and silence it and pound it down. In fact, I was speaking at a large group in eastern Pennsylvania not that long ago, and there was a history professor there who then proceeded to just harangue me on Facebook and other social postings. And I offered to come and speak to he and his class. I said, I'll come out. I'll speak to you for 20 minutes or half an hour, and then just tear me apart. Let's have a discussion. And he said, Greg, I would no sooner have you come out and talk to my class as I would a flat earther. And plus, this was the good part. Well, not so good, actually. He says, I don't want my science or students exposed to this kind of science. That's right, this kind of science. Really? I didn't know that science was one kind or another. But what I talk about in my presentations and in the book are things that don't toe the company line on climate change, and that actually show the Earth is improving. And in fact, I'll share with you, I got a call out of the blue from a fellow by the name of Calvin Beisner, who is the founder of the Cornwall Alliance. It's a Christian group. And he wanted to make my book their April Book of the Month because he said, what you're saying in your book so fully aligns with our philosophy, which turns out to be that they believe that we should use all of God's creation for the betterment of mankind. And he says, do it as good stewards. And you know what? It's hard to argue that, but apparently a lot of people do. So I was their book of the month here a couple of months ago, and I'm a contributing writer for them now. Again, it's not a creationist group, but rather a Christian-based group.
I'm visiting this afternoon with Greg Wrightstone. Greg is the author of a book entitled Inconvenient Facts, The Science That Al Gore Doesn't Want You to Know. Greg, as I was doing some research ahead of this book, I was reading through your book online, and one of the things that struck me and I thought was interesting was when you were talking about different greenhouse gases and how they operate, and I believe you made the statement that CO2 is not the major greenhouse gas. There are other things that have more influence. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. If you go to the National Geographic website, and National Geographic, make no mistake, has been completely leftist radicalized over the last several years. They're all about human-caused catastrophic warming. But the National Geographic site, if you go to their greenhouse page, there'll be a pie chart there listing CO2 as the biggest one. And by doing that, they neglect the main driver of greenhouse gas warming, and that's water vapor. Water vapor can impact up to 95% of the greenhouse warming can be water vapor. Throughout a number of authors, most of the authors I use, and I stated in the book, is 90%, but it's variable depending on how much water vapor is in the atmosphere. So yes, water vapor is the primary green. That's one of the inconvenient facts in the book. And your listeners may not be aware, too. Again, I mentioned earlier, we were a little over 400 parts per million. I don't want to go too many numbers here for you, but prior to our current geologic period, the average carbon dioxide level on Earth was 2,600. Our plants evolved in a time of more than 1,500 parts per million and 2,000 parts per million. So these plants that are alive today, we're actually CO2 impoverished at 400. Plant life responds very well to high CO2. And you're in a somewhat agricultural area, and in the book I represent that a doubling of CO2 will impact. I took a look at crops that make up 95% of the world's food production. A 300 part per million increase in CO2 would lead to a 46% increase in crop growth. That's a good thing. That's a really good thing. And that's why if you look on the back of my truck, I've got a big bumper sticker that says, I heart CO2. And when I speak at conferences, I also have iHeart CO2 buttons and stickers that I pass out, because I truly believe that what we're seeing here is with warming temperatures. Warming temperatures lead to longer growing seasons, more plantings. Killer frosts end earlier in the spring and arrive later in the fall. We're actually the warming temperatures are also freeing up additional land for tillable soil from what it was before. So there's a lot of good things. And we look at if you look at NASA, according to NASA, the Earth, up to 50% of the Earth is what they call greening. In other words, vegetation is increasing. Importantly, only 4% of the Earth, according to NASA, is what they call browning, or having a loss of vegetation. So, boy, those are pretty good odds to have there, that 50% greening and 4% going the other way. I'd take that any day of the week. Now, of course, if you happen to be in that 4% area, too bad for you, but the Earth as a whole is vastly improving and greening and prospering.
Recently, Greg, there were some news reports, and I can remember reading about this, reading the headlines at least, regarding Antarctica and how it's losing its ice, and we're going to face rising sea levels because of this. And give me your take on all that.
Yeah, I did an op-ed. Actually, it was picked up by Ben Shapiro's website last Friday. It took me a while because the report that was released came out a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, that said that Antarctica was melting at three times the rate before, and it took me back, because most of the work by NASA and NOAA had indicated that for years that Antarctica's ice was increasing. So it took a bit of research here, but it turns out that this new report uses the same data that the previous reports do. Bear in mind, they talked about ice volume, and when you calculate that, you have to know what that thickness of ice is, right? Well, the ice can be up to 15,000 feet thick. So, you know, is it 15,000 or is it 14,500 feet? That difference is huge in the way you calculate ice volume. So we have here two camps of scientists disputing measurements from satellite data and using different computational methods. So I don't know. I don't know which one's true, but what we do know, something that's easily measured, and that everyone agrees, is that the area, in other words, the extent of the ice of Antarctica is growing. NASA, NOAA, the National Snow and Ice Data Center that accumulates our government's data on both the Arctic and Antarctic, according to NSIDC, Antarctica has been growing at 1.8% per decade of ice area. And even the report that came out last week stating the ice volume was decreasing, in their introduction they admit the same, that the aerial extent of the ice is expanding. So, you know, Antarctica is not melting away, and it won't, because most of Antarctica is at minus 25 or 30 degrees centigrade, well below any kind of melting that's going to go on there. In addition, the places that Antarctica is losing ice, Western Antarctica, which I point out in my op-ed, it overlies, the ice is on top of what's thought to be the densest accumulation of volcanoes on Earth. It's been called nature's blowtorch. So the Western Antarctica ice is receding, but it's probably, a lot of it's due to the geothermal heat coming up from the Earth through these volcanic and what's called a spreading center under the ice.
Greg, one of the things that you said in your book, and I thought was really interesting, is that, and you won't ever hear this from somebody that's out there talking about global warming and climate change and how we're just on the brink of doomsday. But one of the things you contend is that the warming effect of carbon dioxide lessens as the concentration increases in the atmosphere. Explain that for us.
Yeah, it's a logarithmic, for any of your math majors out there, decreases. In other words, that first 100 parts per million of CO2 has a much greater warming effect than the next 100 parts per million. And then the next 100 parts per million has even less. It's not an analogy I like to use, although it's not exact, but it gives your listeners some kind of an idea. It'd be like if you put a coat of white paint on your front window, right? That first coat of paint blocks out, what, 35, 40% of the light maybe. And then that second coat of white paint blocks out more light, but not nearly as much as that first coat of paint, and so on and so on and so on. And it's somewhat similar in terms of the warming effect with CO2. So as we're adding CO2, each additional bit of CO2, every molecule of CO2 warms significantly less than those previous molecules, because there's only so much of this wavelength, the warming wavelength that they can pick up. And that's why we didn't have runaway warming at times of Earth's history when we had 6,000 and 8,000 parts per million. You'll hear the alarmists talk about, oh, well, we're going to get to runaway warming. Well, it's not going to happen because of that, the logarithmic warming effect decreasing with CO2. It didn't happen in the past, and it won't happen again here in the future.
Greg, I can imagine that there is a listener out there today who's taking in this conversation, and they've got to be, they're probably thinking to themselves, this guy, this Wrightstone, he is crazy. He is telling me that CO2 is a good thing, that global warming is a good thing. what do you say to somebody like that?
Well, I would suggest if they're in front of a computer, just Google NASA greening and Sahara, those three keywords, and see what NASA says about this. What they're going to find is that the increasing temperature leads to higher water vapor in the atmosphere, which leads to more precipitation, coupled with increasing CO2. The CO2 fertilization effect means that the pores on the plants, the stomata of the plants are smaller, and the plants don't need as much water. So the earth is greening. Now, you'll find that, again, the study I talked about earlier about NASA greening effect, the scientists that look at it attribute it to climate change. You'll find that the southern Sahara, the Sahel, is turning into a lush grassland. It was an arid desert. The people hadn't lived in for thousands of years. People, animals are moving back in there. And again, you can just Google NASA greening in Sahara and see what they say. It's an amazing story. They're getting animals, gazelles, even amphibians are moving back into these areas. People are starting to farm former desert. And again, the experts that you'll read about that are attributing it to increasing soil moisture and CO2 fertilization effect for the plants. And we're seeing it not just in the southern Sahara, but parts of Australia and India. And it's the alarmists will say, oh, well, the increased precipitation will lead to flooding. And they may have a point in some areas, of course. If it's going to rain more, you may get more flooding. But what we're seeing is this precipitation occurring in a lot of cases in areas that really need it. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. And it's we're able to continue to increase our crops and what we're growing every year. There were recent studies on famine that increased warming was going to cause corn failures and that vegetables would have vegetables not grow, and there'd be famine related to vegetable crops. But again, these people are using they're using the flawed climate models that overpredict warming. And then they take these two studies on famine, used the very highest predictions of temperatures to indicate that temperatures will increase 4 degrees centigrade, which is about 7 degrees Fahrenheit, over the next 50 or 80 years, wherein actually the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, says the most likely case is much less than half of that. So they're taking these dire predictions of increasing temperatures and then coming up with predictions of gloom and doom and climate catastrophe. It's important to separate projections of what may or may not occur in 50 or 80 years from what's actually happening today. And that's what I like to do in the book. And in the book, I showed just how much, in terms of crops, how they keep increasing every year. Of course, a lot of that's due to mechanization, modification of crops, various practices that are using, but certainly the rise in temperatures and the increasing CO2 can't hurt that. And the other thing, too, we have to look at, fascinating part of the book was where I relate the relationship between rise and fall of temperatures and the rise and fall of civilizations. During the past warming periods over the last 4,000 years, every time we got into a big warming period, great civilizations rose up. During the Minoan warm period, which was much, much hotter than today, we saw the first rise of the great Mediterranean cultures and the first Egyptians with Akhenaten and such. And then between each of these warm periods, it got cold. They had names like the Greek Dark Ages, the Dark Ages, the Little Ice Age. In each case, in those cooling periods, we saw crop failure, we saw famine, pestilence, mass depopulation. Man, bad, bad things happen when it gets cold. And we see that civilizations thrive and prosper during warmth because they can grow more crops. If you were Emperor Dave in a warm period, you could feed your population. But if you're Emperor Dave in the middle of a cooling period and you couldn't feed your subjects, you wouldn't be Emperor Dave for very long. And that, we see that that's what happens time and again. So warm is good, cold is bad.
Greg, it's been a lot of fun visiting with you here today, and I was sure that it would be. If we have a listener out there that would like to be able to get a copy of your book or take a look at your website to learn more about your work, how can they go about doing that?
Yeah, go to inconvenientfacts.xyz. Make sure they hit the subscribe button. They can buy it there and get $5 off. There's a coupon number that to use in the front, but inconvenientfacts.xyz. And, of course, it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. We just got it into the Barnes & Noble brick-and-mortar stores just a few weeks ago. But I really do appreciate being able to share some of the story from the book here with you and your listeners. It's very much appreciated.
I want to take a moment now to thank you for spending some time with us here today, and also thank you for writing this book. I think that anytime somebody stands up and says, now, wait a minute, what we're being told is not the entire truth, and we need to look at what else is going on out here, I think that's very valuable. So thank you for all of that.
You betcha. Glad to do it.
That's Gregory Wrightstone joining me here this afternoon on Alive at 5. His book, Inconvenient Facts, The Science That Al Gore Doesn't Want You to Know. Keep it tuned right here to Yankton's home team, AM 1450 KYNT, and we'll be right back after this.